Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, and clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome. I'm Jeremy Maggs. Coming up on the program, can the new NPA head finally deliver real prosecutions? A new plastic ban push. The Drakenstein municipality staking its claim as South Africa's green trailblazer. Why 2025 proved that people still want humans behind customer service. And a new diabetes alert. South Africa's monitoring crisis is sparking urgent calls for action. It's Thursday, the 8th of January.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa's prosecuting landscape shifting in a big way this week. President Ramaphosa naming advocate Andy Motibi as the new National Director of Public Prosecutions, and that places him at the helm of an NPA that is under intense pressure to deliver real accountability. Business Leadership South Africa has welcomed the appointment, saying his performance at the SIU shows that he can drive reform and also recover stolen public funds. Let's bring you more on the story now. The Chief Executive Officer of BLSA, Busisiwe Mavuso, a very warm welcome to you. Why are you confident then that Andy Motibi can fix an NPA that, as well know, has struggled for years to secure successful prosecutions?
Jeremy, thank you, and thanks for the invitation. Look, I really think that his experience and his track record speaks for himself. I really think that looking at what he has done and what he has achieved within the SIU, it makes him the appropriate and relevant appointment for this crucial role. He has done an excellent job in as far as the SIU is concerned. He has recovered millions of rands that were lost to corruption. He has put in place the necessary reforms to enhance institutional performance, and he will no doubt, be the right person to take the NPA to the next level.
The SIU track record is strong, that is a given, but we all know the NPA is a very different environment. The challenge, of course, is to make sure that those skills transfer.
Absolutely, but I think if you look at what needs to be done as well, we can't put Andy in the same difficult position that we actually put Shamila in. There needs to be certain reforms that are going to have to be implemented within the NPA to ensure that it can actually operate in a different manner. So look at how SARS operates, for instance, in terms of the independence that SARS has. SARS, for instance, has been able to recover more fully, in part because of the structural advantages that the NPA lacks. The SARS commissioner has genuine authority over the organization. He's the accounting authority, effectively the CEO with the power to hire and fire senior staff. Shamila doesn't have that latitude. You would remember that she actually had to beg the president for more than 2 years to remove Andrew Chauke, after she had raised concerns that Andrew Chauke is not actually the right person to hold office, and therefore makes it difficult, for someone to be put in that position with their hands tied behind their back and expected to perform miracles. So there is a need to reform the architecture of the institution so that it is truly independent. As it stands, the NPA operates as a program within the Department of Justice, and it has the DG of the Department of Justice as its official accounting officer. So we're going to have to look at those things. Otherwise, we are going to be putting Andy in exactly the same difficult position that Shamila was actually put in. So I have no doubt that it's got the skills, it's got the expertise, it knows what it's doing, but the structure and the architecture of the institution will actually, undermine what it can possibly offer to the NPA.
And you've put your finger on the single biggest problem in terms of that reform, and there's no guarantee that's going to happen. We know that political interference has undermined the NDP for over a decade now. How difficult do you think it's going to be for him to protect the institution from the risk that you've just raised?
It's actually going to be difficult, especially if he's not going to have the minister and the DG of the Department of Justice who are actually going to be supporting him. Remember, even if he wanted to bring the right people on board to try and ensure that he can actually progress, you know, and better position the NPA, he doesn't sit with that prerogative. The prerogative of senior appointments sits with the Minister of Justice and the President, a power which in the history of our democracy has actually been invoked, you know, for good and ill, you know, so it really makes it therefore difficult, you know, from an independence perspective, you know, to say how does he actually go ahead doing what he needs to do. So I really think that we have done a lot of work as a country from a reform perspective, but we all acknowledge that the criminal justice system, you know, is the one area that is lagging behind. We just haven't done enough. But also, if we are serious about reforming this institute, we are serious about reforming the criminal justice system in its entirety, what has come out of the Madlanga Commission, Jeremy, should actually serve as an impetus for us to start taking seriously some of those things. We are going to soon be sitting with that report from the Madlanga Commission. That report can't, you know, sit idle the way the state capture report said. You know, if we want to enable the NPA, the SIU, the police and everyone in the criminal justice system to actually do something about some of the things that have come out from the Madlanga Commission, we're therefore going to have to look at what do we need to do and what powers do we need to give some of these institutions for them to be able to do something about the report.
To be fair, he hasn't started the job yet. He hasn't even found his parking bay, but business obviously wants swift, credible action on corruption. Do you have a sense of what kind of timeline he should be held to for delivering visible progress?
The timeline will be aligned to how quickly we can actually give him the fair and necessary powers to can do his job. Because we can say we need him to do this within 6 months. If he's not going to be given the independence, if he's not going to be allowed to bring in the right people to can actually drive the progress of the NPA forward, then we are actually wasting our time. The timeline that we should be putting as a country in place is not of how of what ND should do when, it is how quickly the reforms that are required to the NPA should actually be done. Once we've put in those reforms, then the timeline can actually start ticking. As things stand, I really think that it is going to be difficult. Be that as it may, however, I have no doubt, you know, that the same that Shamila did her absolute best to actually produce the results that she produced with this tough environment that she was actually thrust in, Andrew will definitely do the same. But I think would be naive to think that would see, you know, remarkable progress and would see a significant shift without actually giving Andrew and the true independence the way SARS has, the way the South African Reserve Bank has. So we're really going to have to look at those tweaks to this institution, you know, to enable Andy to do his job.
Thank you very much indeed. The Chief Executive Officer of Business Leadership South Africa, Busisiwe Mavuso. I always appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa could see its first municipality ban single-use plastics. The Drakenstein municipality in the Cape Winelands has put forward a draft integrated waste management bylaw that would outlaw items like plastic bags, straws and polystyrene, setting a potential benchmark for local government action on plastic waste in the country. Critics, though, are warning about practical challenges for residents and businesses. With me now to discuss the step is André Kuchlenberg from the Drakenstein municipality. André, a very warm welcome to you. Why do you think this municipality of yours should lead the country in this respect? Isn't it a national issue that needs national legislation first?
Jeremy, thank you for the compliment and just a bit of a correction. I'm not the chief whip anymore. I used to be, but I am the MACO member of Drakenstein, responsible for amongst waste, amongst others. But anyhow, the thing is, I agree totally with you. It has to be a national issue, but in the absence of national government taking bold steps towards the future of waste management in South Africa, we decided to go it not alone, but take the first bold steps to be to create the environment where we think we need to be and the rest of South Africa need to be in the near future. Otherwise, we're going to be drowning in our own waste. Literally speaking.
André, you've obviously done your homework, but is there evidence that a local ban will significantly reduce plastic pollution rather than just shift the problem somewhere else?
We believe so. You believe so, because this is not only a ban on on single-use plastics. There are lots of other desired outcomes like recycling, etc., etc. But as we say, if nothing happens from national side, municipalities has to take ownership for their own environments, and we're taking this bold step. Obviously, you mentioned that it is in draft form at the moment, and it went out for public public participation. And at the moment, as we speak, our staff is busy working through all the comments that has been received, and that will inform our local leadership and council on the way to go. But we would love to promote the draft version of our bylaw as it was sent out, as good as it was sent out in the original form.
As I understand it, it covers items like straws and polystyrene, but many businesses might say that alternatives are costly or even hard to source. Yeah. How would you respond to that?
That might be true, but I think in the long run, one has to remember of where is this going to end if cost is the only measurement that you would use to whether you're going to go for it or not, or whether you are against it. What we did is I also made a presentation with Thijs Serpentine, our senior manager of waste management in Drakensberg. We made a very well attended monthly meeting of our local Drakensberg business chamber, and what we've presented there was very, very well accepted. We've also did some advertising through our Drakensberg web, media statements, WhatsApp groups, etc., etc. And what I've asked the people to respond to is, can you find something that you object against? And if you object against something in the draft bylaw, please give me a reason for that. Don't just object. Give me the reason why you object. Also tell me what do you support? I mean, it's the Clarkoser. If you want to object to something, you would find many reasons to do that. But is there something that you can support? And lastly, if you spot something that you would have expected to be in the draft or in the new proposed bylaw, and you don't see that, please tell me about that and give me the reason for that. Went the extra mile.
Let's assume that your bylaw is passed. I assume that there would be concrete enforcement mechanisms that would be put in place and that you would monitor compliance fairly. How are you going to do that?
Obviously, I think, with respect to the comments that's going to come in, we would most probably decide on a phased-in approach, because the approach now in this new proposed bylaw is vastly different from the version of 2020, which is the date for the current one in existence. So we're going to most probably on the very serious matters, like, for instance, single-use plastics, have a phased-in approach, because the shops have stocks of single use that they distribute every day, so it's going to be a phased in process. Obviously, that phased in process cannot be 5 or 7 or 10 years. There will be restrictions to that, but obviously I think the best way to go is not from a zero tolerance, but they have a tolerance in terms of a phased-in approach.
And if Drakensberg succeeds, do you expect other municipalities to follow suit? What indication are you getting, or do you think this initiative is going to face resistance?
I expect a bit of resistance, but, Jeremy, we have been talking about this whole approach to other municipalities, might I say leading municipalities, with Drakensberg as one of the leading municipalities, also City of Cape Town. And we have not met resistance in terms of the goals, objectives that we're setting out. It's maybe Drakensberg taking the first bold steps, very bold steps, to make this reality. Because, we have to save landfill space as well. The new laws for getting an okay from the legal authorities on landfill spaces are so stringent that most municipalities, if not all of them, are facing deadlines within a year, 5, 7 from now, where the current landfill space are going to be closed because of reaching its maximum height or for other reasons. So we have to think differently about waste in the future.
There's absolutely no doubt that plastic pollution is a global issue. André Kuchtenberg, thank you very much indeed from the Drakenstein Municipality. Yeah. Appreciate your time today. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, artificial intelligence may have taken center stage in 2025, but consumers didn't follow the script. They rewarded speed, empathy, and real problem solving, and not bots. And as customer frustration grew, it's becoming clear that technology may scale service, but it doesn't replace trust. And I want to talk about that because it's an issue that affects us all. And I'm in conversation now with Liesel Jonkert, director of the Consumer Psychology Lab, to discuss why the next frontier of customer experience is less possibly about automation and more about genuine human connection. Liesel, a very warm welcome to you. And as I say, this is an issue that affects each and every one of us. Did 2025 prove that companies may be over-invested in AI and under-invested in people?
I think the challenge isn't the overinvestment. I think it's the focus probably. That's more of the challenge, because if you invest in the tech part, there's a lot of benefits. And as we, you know, we can see that there's a lot more speed in the engagement with organizations, but the quality is lacking. And the human connection is lacking, because you are not able necessarily to resolve complex problems, because you can't talk to a human, and AI cannot, or let me say at this point, the sophistication of the AI in the customer service environment is still not optimal.
Liesel, when you say the quality is lacking, what specifically do you mean? Are you able to illustrate that with an example?
Very often when you reach out to organizations with a complex problem, some of the examples would be with the mobile companies, etc., and they use bot technology. When you try to articulate your problem, it just feeds back generic content. So the frustration is there's no way to actually reach a human through the normal channels to resolve your problem. So when it becomes complex, you struggle through reams of suggested content to work through, but you can't find the answer. And if there's no alternative to speak to a human, it becomes really disconnected. And your frustration is just, the frustration just escalates.
And that's so true in so many instances. And what do you think the consequence of that consumer frustration is? Do people simply give up engaging with the brand, or do they take their business elsewhere?
Well, I guess it depends. You know, the typical barrier to exit in the banking environment, for instance, is very real. So, you know, you think to yourself, well, if I go from this bank to another, will I not just repeat the same problems? And the complexity of moving from one bank to another perhaps prohibits people to jump quickly to another brand. Although I think consumer brands, people will be more inclined to give up and jump. I think it depends on the value of the product that you sit with, or the service that you require, because, you know, it's not always easy to just walk away from it. But it does escalate consumer frustration. And by the time that they escalate the problem, and maybe if they reach a human, they become almost irrationally angry. And I think for the frontliners dealing with that, it becomes really a hot seat to sit.
The reality, of course, Liesel, is that big organizations, particularly in the telco space and in the banking space, are not going to stop deploying artificial intelligence to cut costs, are they?
Yeah, I think the reality is that, unfortunately, a lot of the big corporates use AI to solve their own problems and not necessarily the customer's problems. And you know, it's a phenomena that we see in many dimensions, not only in the tech component, but, you know, even in the customer feedback loops. You know, you're using tech to try and resolve your manpower issues or your cost issues, but you do not necessarily reach the audience and hear what their real frustrations are. So I think it cuts on many levels, that organizations see the bottom line as the driver and not the customer as the core of why they change their strategies to use and implement more tech.
So, Liesel, from a psychological perspective, then, what advice would you give to consumers when they confront the problems that you've outlined for me?
I wish I had an easy answer. I think, the easy ones, when you are able to use tech sufficiently or effectively, would be, with the easy questions that you have. But I would seek, as far as I possibly can, other alternatives to connect with organizations, because it is really, really frustrating to use the channels available, like with the mobile companies and banking environment specifically, insurance as well, and you cannot talk to a human. So I would advise to keep on searching for an option, alternative channels to communicate. I think especially if it's complex, if it's an, you want a statement or documentation, don't use call centers for that. If you can use apps, I mean, that reduces the pressure on the call center agents. So yeah, I guess there's not an easy way.
And just a final question then, on the flip side, what should big organizations be doing to find that balance between artificial intelligence, which is here to stay, and that consumer empathy that you've been talking to me about?
Jeremy, I think the biggest challenge is really to start building in elements that sound more human, feel more human. I think AI is moving fast in that direction. If you look at the effective use of voice, bringing in really new technology in terms of sounding more human, I think the further we go, the smarter it becomes. Recently, there was a statement made by Elon Musk and the like to say, the smartphones will disappear, where Apple, Tim Cook said, no, it is not. It is how you use the technology available. And I think that's the crux, is, are you able to solve problems and to connect with a human? And I think using AI and making sure that those elements come through will be key. And I just don't think it will ever replace the human connection. It will serve a huge component of your customer base. It'll save you cost on many levels, but you cannot do that in isolation.
I'm going to leave it there. My thanks to Liesl Jonke, Director of the Consumer Psychology Lab. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa is facing a silent crisis in diabetes care, and some experts say the system needs a serious upgrade. Continuous glucose monitors are becoming essential tools for early detection and even better long-term management. Yet accuracy, affordability, and access remain big hurdles. And there's a new push underway now to improve regulation, funding, and real-time monitoring. And it could reshape patient outcomes and, I imagine, the wider healthcare economy. Let's discuss this. I'm in conversation now with Kirsten de Klerk, co-founder of the SA Diabetes Advocacy. Kirsten, a very warm welcome to you. How serious is the accuracy problem with current monitoring devices in the country?
Yes, it's wonderful to be here today with you to explain exactly what we are facing. So at the moment, what we're seeing is sort of cheaper alternatives coming into the market. And while we welcome that because of the high costs of the better quality continuous glucose monitors, obviously we want to push for access to these wonderful devices, specifically for people living with diabetes. But what we are seeing now is that there are cheaper alternatives coming into the market. And some of these devices have been tested on fewer than 17 people living with diabetes before they even go onto market, and they are being specifically marketed to the target population of people living with diabetes. So that's become a huge cause of concern. And because these devices are not regulated, they are coming into the market without being tested accurately. And what we are seeing from community specifically is people having severe diabetes complications, such as really, really low diabetes glucose events or continuous high glucose events, because of the fact that the continuous glucose monitors that they are using are giving inaccurate readings. For example, a parent of a child called in to say that their child had ended up in diabetic ketoacidosis, which is a coma state, life-threatening condition, because the readings on the sensor that she was using were inaccurate.
So how then do you improve regulatory oversight on the quality and testing of these monitors entering the local market?
Yeah, so it's a very difficult thing because currently there are no global ISO standards, which is a big problem, which means that it's not being regulated at a global standard, which means it's definitely not being regulated at a South African standpoint. So what we're trying to do as diabetes organizations in South Africa is we've come together to create 6 questions. So we worked with global organizations to come up with 6 questions that people can ask. So not only is this impacting the person living with diabetes or the caregiver to children or elderly people living with diabetes, but it's also impacting the prescribers such as the doctors, and it's impacting the funders such as the private medical aid schemes as well as the public healthcare sector when it comes to knowing which devices they can trust and which devices to prescribe to people living with diabetes. So in the interim, while there are no ISO standards or regulatory processes in place for this, we have developed 6 questions that you can ask before choosing a continuous glucose monitor by really looking at the evidence that is available when it comes to the studies that have been performed on the device.
Are medical schemes themselves, Kirsten, resistant to funding CGMs?
Medical schemes have really come to the party over the last 4 years. You'll see some of the bigger medical aid schemes are funding it specifically for children under the age of 18. So that's become quite a great marker. And then it kind of works on a tiered plan depending on what price point you're paying per month. So it's definitely, they're definitely taking it up. But I think the issue is now that they are seeing that there are cheap alternatives available. So instead of funding the trusted devices, they are now opting to fund cheap alternatives, which obviously comes to, it has its consequences both for the medical aid funder, because in the long term, it's going to obviously increase the risk of complications, hospitalizations, emergency events when it comes to glucose levels. And then obviously for the person living with diabetes, it comes at a big risk. So what we're trying to do is, that's why we develop these tools, and we're going to be obviously putting this out to all the private funders as well as the public healthcare sector to really start educating around what it is that they should look for when it comes to continuous glucose monitoring and which devices to trust. But we're definitely seeing some great response from some of the larger medical aid schemes when it comes to not just funding any device, but actually having a thorough check, background check on what has been studied on these devices.
Kirsten, I imagine it comes down to the question about what costs the country more, making CGMs more widely available or treating uncontrolled diabetes later.
Definitely. I think, you know, we always talk about that we really need to start putting in these preventative actions instead of treating the consequences or the symptoms later on when they arise. So the cost could definitely in the long term reduce when it comes to funding devices like this, because you're really empowering the person living with diabetes to take action within their day-to-day management. Currently, private medical aid funders offer 5 testing strips a day. And in the public healthcare system, you're seeing 3 finger prick testing kits strips per day. So that's the traditional method of checking your glucose levels. Whereas with these continuous glucose monitors, you're getting a reading update every single minute of the day. You're being alerted when your glucose levels are too high or too low. And for most people in South Africa, you're probably seeing your healthcare professional for 15 minutes twice a year if you're lucky. So for the rest of the year, you have to make all those decisions on your own.
And just finally, complicating the problem in South Africa, I imagine, is a wide access gap between private medical schemes and public sector patients.
Yes, it's hugely unavailable in the public healthcare space. There have been some pilot studies taking place in the public healthcare sector in South Africa to see if the access to these sort of devices in the public healthcare sector, specifically for children, if that does have a huge benefit on the diabetes management results year on year. And then in the private healthcare space, there is still quite a gap in terms of having to pay co-payments. So a cash portion of it not being funded and having to come out of pocket. So we really are seeing that the access to continuous glucose monitoring has been poorly received in South Africa, even though it has become standard of care globally in most settings.
Kirsten de Klerk, thank you very much indeed. Co-founder of SA Diabetes Advocacy. I appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.